Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle. Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Thank you so much for checking it out. Today, we have a really interesting, fun, and cool conversation with Michelle Perron. She is going to talk about drinking for a lifespan in a healthy way. So basically, how do we drink it away that doesn't hurt ourselves, doesn't hurt our body, doesn't hurt our brain? We don't kill ourselves early and we get to drink when we're old and continue drinking when we're old and have it not be problematic. So that's my synopsis. Michelle would probably have a much more eloquent way of putting it, but there you go. So we dive into a lot of different aspects of alcohol and the cultural challenges and this aspect of alcohol, something many of us love, and it's kind of a poison, and there's sort of cultural negative attitudes around it, and how do we address it in a different way so that we can just be real with the fact that many of us are going to drink, and how are we going to do it safely? And how do we frame it in our mind to help us support doing that for ourselves? I come to this conversation as a person who really does not drink very much alcohol, and that's neither here nor there in some ways. But the point that I want to make with that is that if you are somebody who doesn't drink very much, and so you might think, I'm not a drinker, so there's nothing I can gain from this. There's a ton you can gain from this. I really enjoyed the conversation. Just thinking about all of this and alcohol. Michelle is a private recovery and addiction coach. She has a doctorate in counseling and is also a certified coach. So she's somebody that a person who, if they're needing to work with somebody on addictive issues, you can work with her in the privacy of your own home. And again, she's going to talk about that. But a lot of what we're focusing on today is more of the concept around alcohol. How much is safe? Meaning, yes, you can look at the guidelines and you can see what their limits are. And Michelle's perspective is about how much can we drink and how often to be healthy, to not hurt our bodies, to not affect our brain. And she talks about everything from how long does it take to get our brain sort of back in order when we've had a couple drinks, and just looking at alcohol for what it is. It's something that we enjoy. It's something that is very prevalent in our culture. It's kind of everywhere, and we tend to focus more on the negatives of what it does to people and how it is when it is out of control, rather than sort of the positive and the realities of how do we just do this and drink alcohol in sort of a responsible way. So she's looking at being able to drink through our lifespan. How much, how often can we have alcohol and do it in a way that if we choose to drink alcohol, that we can not hurt ourselves and continue to have it throughout our life. One of the distinctions that she makes that I think is fantastic is there's the CDC regulations for alcohol. And then there's the keeping yourself healthy regulations for alcohol. So those are some of the things that she's talking about. And she talks very specifically about how many drinks and how often. And you might be surprised. Alcohol is something that is very much in our culture in very many ways. And we have intriguing attitudes about it personally and collectively. And Michelle brings a great perspective and with a non-judgmental attitude about it, but helping us all be a little bit more informed and maybe opening up a little different conversation around it, which I think is fantastic. I hope you enjoyed the interview. I had a great time doing it. We covered a lot of ground. So let's head right on in and have Michelle tell us how to enjoy drinking for a lifetime and do it in a healthy way. Well, Michelle, go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us what you do.
Well, hello, my name is Dr. Michelle Perron, and I'm a recovery and addiction coach as well as counselor. I've been doing it for about 11 years in the Duluth area, but now I do it online internationally. So I have clients all over the world, and I really enjoy what I do.
So how did you get here? Like, this is very specific, right?
Yes.
So how did you get here? What drives you to be here? What brought you to this place?
Well, originally I ended up in the Duluth area to start another business, and it was a restaurant, and everyone loved it, but unfortunately it didn't make it. And so when I retooled the factory and went to look for something else to do, I really got interested in alcohol and drug counseling. I love the Duluth area, raised my children here, and so I stayed in Duluth.
Nice. Okay. Was there anything in particular that drew you to the alcohol and addiction? Like,
yes.
Was there something that was like,
yes,
oh my gosh, I have to do this, or an experience?
Yes. Like many of us, I was married to an alcoholic, and unfortunately, it was a big part of our demise, our divorce, and from that, I saw the effects that it had not only on my life, but on my children's lives. And so as I started to learn more, and as I started to develop more and become part of recovery groups, support groups in the area, and start to understand the disease, I got very interested in it and started to study and got my certification and just moved from there. It was out of the desire to know more, maybe a little bit the wife that would wish I could have changed things or gone back. But I have discovered in this work that I share a lot of the emotional underpinnings, and I think that the field has a lot of growth potential. There's a lot that can be done differently, and I've found in my work in 11 years that there are certain things that I specialized in that really worked with clients. And so the reason I'm no longer working in the agency work is that I prefer to use energy psychology, because I think that's the kind of psychology that works the most quickly, the most effectively, and can really get some relief for people who are suffering from substance use disorders.
So energy psychology, mm-hmm. Talk about what that is a little bit.
That differs a little bit from regular talk psychology and cognitive behavioral methods. Those things work well. However, they sometimes don't go that extra mile depending on who's using them. Energy psychology has more to do with those techniques that are hypnosis, EMDR, EFT, those sort of newer branches of psychology that are moving into the psychology association.
Okay. Interesting. That's really cool. So we could dive into all of that too, but let's just for information's sake, talk about just what does EFT and EMDR, right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what those acronyms stand for, just in case somebody is interested in maybe learning a little bit more about what that is.
Okay. So EFT is emotional freedom technique, and you may have more commonly known about it as tapping.
Yes.
And so those are tapping on what they perceive to be energy meridians on the body, and it actually readjusts the electrical balance in the brain. And so you can get to the heart of the problem without reliving or using desensitization therapy like the military does with PTSD. So if you do desensitization, you walk the person very vividly through the experience that caused the trauma in the first place, and then they relive it and listen to it and listen to the tapes over and over until they no longer feel the feelings of going through that. But I think if you've experienced trauma and you're asked to relive it and relive it and relive it till you don't feel it anymore, I personally don't think that's humane. Mm-hmm. I think it's more of a torturous sort of thing. I don't think it's helpful to the client. It may work in the military studies, but the way that they get there, I think, is just not as humane as it could be. It just seems like it would be much more painful to do it that way.
Right.
So EFT goes to the emotions that are associated with the event, but not necessarily going through each event blow by blow. So you don't go back and talk about the vivid details, but you do talk about the feelings. And with a few sessions, you can tap at the core of the feelings, and then the whole psychological framework that's holding up that trauma will collapse and you will have some relief. And so it's very effective. There have been a number of studies that demonstrate the effectiveness of EFT.
It's kind of amazing.
It is.
And I've known people who have used it, and I've played with it a little bit myself, but probably not well enough or long enough. But it is fascinating, because it seems like, well,
How can this work?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
for our Western ways of, you know, very physical, very in the body, very direct science, this is so much in a different, the Eastern philosophy, that it's kind of outside of our wheelhouse. Yeah. We look at that and go, how does this work? I don't know. It worked. It worked personally for me, which is what led me into the FTA world. I was having some panic attacks when I was shopping years ago, and I decided to use that in the changing room. And in a matter of a few minutes, the anxiety attack, the panic attack went away and never came back. It's been 15 years.
Wow. That's really cool. Yeah.
It was so effective that I started to go into that, and now I use it with clients.
Okay. And EMDR?
EMDR is an eye movement desensitization protocol, and it's a lot like going into areas that aren't quite exactly measurable. However, they do have you go back into what your trauma is, remember it, and then they have you do a sequence of counting and moving your eyes in certain rotations back and forth, left and right, up and down. And through that, it rewires the brain as well. So it changes that memory. So when you go back to remember it, you don't have the same emotions associated with it. That too, it seems like, how can you do that and change?
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And so therefore, these are new evidence-based treatments. There is research supporting that, but the energy psychology field is moving to become part of the APA, the American Psychology Association,
okay,
because these techniques are very effective. And for people who are struggling and aren't getting relief from talk therapy or medications, these energy solutions are very effective.
Yay. Like, we need more of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we don't understand sometimes when you're doing it, you don't understand how it works, but and to be able to be open-minded to what's possible.
Yeah. And the beauty is there are no side effects from medications, mm-hmm. You know, re-traumatizing when you're talking about things with counselors over and over. The cherished 50-minute session is not necessarily the same amount of time that you're getting through your information. A session may need to be longer, 90 minutes, maybe mm-hmm. even 2 hours. If it's a deep dive, coaching allows for intensives that may last, like you may hire a coach for a day and you do an intensive where you go deep dive and you do 4 or 5 hours, you know, and you mm-hmm. may take a lunch break in there. But traditional counseling will have a 50-minute session, and not everything gets covered that way, and it'll take a long time. So these deep dive sessions are worth it with counselors. They can, or with coaches, that they can really go into it that way. And so we work a little differently in the coaching field.
So talk about, before we dive into our topic at hand, you mentioned you are a counselor and a coach. So tell me just a little bit, help us understand what the difference between those two things are.
A counselor has licensure through the state or the federal government. So, for instance, I have licenses in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and also I'm internationally licensed. So that means I've agreed to certain standards of care and that I've gone through schooling and I have all the credentials necessary to perform the certain evidence-based treatment that I've been taught to administer. So I have a PhD in counseling, which is a little more unusual in the alcohol and drug field. Most people have an alcohol and drug license, which is 2 to 4 year. It's a 4-year degree now. And then you have an internship with that. And so too with mental health, it's a 4-year degree and then an internship. And then you'll have psychologists with the master's degree, a little bit more education, and then you'll have, of course, psychiatrists that have their doctorate and they have the medical MD with that. So there's a difference between counseling, and this is an important thing, psychology and psychiatry. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, what's the difference? Well, psychiatry involves medical health in your body. So they give you pills to solve the solution. They don't really go into talk therapy much. Mm-hmm. They just will give you a pill that will change your brain and hopefully work. And so, unfortunately, the hopefully work thing, they may try many different medications before they find the one that works for you.
Right.
So you have to be willing to go through that process. Psychology works on quantitative information. So they measure how many people in a population have this problem, and they will measure which method works best with that problem, and therefore they'll go ahead with that method with that problem. So it's very much a numbers thing with psychology. They will use many of the same techniques as a counselor, but they're concerned about the statistics surrounding what you have and what statistically works. A counselor is qualitative, so they want to know how you feel and why you feel that way.
Right. Okay.
So it's more about the emotional set and more about what avenues can we use to make you help you feel better? And psychology will say, well, let's look at your biopsychosocial, which we also look at, but they'll look at it more in a quantitative. How much, how big, how many, how do we change that behavior, that kind of stuff. So there's a slight difference. We all kind of do the same thing, mm-hmm. but our philosophies differ a little bit.
Okay.
So coaching, how does that fit in?
Mm-hmm.
Coaching is different. They're certified by the IFC, and there are many, many programs. So when looking for a coach, you should look at what program they were trained under. Some are, you know, 6-month programs, some are 3-year programs, whatever it is. So you can kind of gauge the certification of your coach, like see if they and how they fit and feel to you, if you're liking what they're saying, if you like what they're going to teach you, if you're interested in what they're doing. But coaches primarily are unregulated, except for voluntarily through the IFC. So there are many really good coaches out there, and then there are many that don't have the qualifications but want to help others.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I have felt and seen in coaching is there are many people who are heart-centered, much more intimately concerned with the well-being of their clients. It's not so much that I have to see you for 50 minutes and goodbye, mm-hmm. but it's more, who are you? What are you about? How can I help you reach your goals and move forward? So rather than dealing with the pathology, which counselors, psychologists, and psychiatrists work with, coaches work with your possibility, with your potential. So we assume that you are at a basic good functioning level, and we move into your goals from there.
Okay. Yeah, it is. It is. I appreciate your distinction between all of them, because I think that's something that we kind of understand. But it is, what do you want out of what you're trying to do as to who you need to go and talk to,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
So it's great.
So as a counselor and coach, what I like to do is I usually start with people with the mindset of coaching, like how can we move forward? But when I see blocks to moving forward, then I'm able, because I have the credentials, to go back and say, okay, instead of referring you back out to somebody else who may or may not understand you the way I do, I can go back and say, okay, let's clean this up, and mm-hmm. then we'll be able to move forward.
Right.
So it allows me to work in both spaces.
Nice. That was awesome. Thank you. I actually really do appreciate your distinction. I think that's a big deal. And then what you bring from all of those spheres. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So let's dive in to the topic that we kind of are focusing on. I'm really excited to talk about this just because I think it's really interesting and I'm interested in your perspective on it. So drinking throughout your life in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm.
So let's dive into what that means. I'm thinking, so let me just tell you what comes to my mind when I think of this discussion a little bit, and not necessarily what you're going to say, but when I think about being in college and, you know, all of the sort of unhealthy things that I've seen through my life when it comes to seeing binge drinking. And I was just having a conversation with somebody recently who lives by the university campus and was just like, oh my gosh, I'm seeing these girls from this house down the street who they're literally, it's 10 o'clock in the morning and they're totally drunk. And one, you know, he said one girl got offended because she fell. And he said he could see that she was most likely drunk and the other person who was with her was most likely drunk. And he said, you know, can I help you? And they get kind of mad, like, you know, leave us alone, we're fine. But his concern is living right. He's like, I'm seeing people who are just drinking to drink. He's like, I don't even know if there's an enjoyment besides drinking. And I, you know, riding the bus to school, to college, and hearing some of the people in the discussions around their drinking and the stats at UMD of, like, we have less people drinking alcohol but more binge drinking.
Yeah.
So things are shifting, and it's concerning to see, like, this time of taking it all in and overdoing it,
yeah,
right in the beginning,
yeah,
which is kind of, to me, I sort of unfortunate, and it's unnecessary in my opinion, but I've, you know, passed that part of my life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was never a part of my life either. It's never been something that's really drawn me. Alcohol and I have an interesting relationship just because I think my body metabolizes it interestingly and changed over time.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking of, you know, people that I know who drink, you know, maybe functionally, but drink a lot, and their bodies for whatever reason are sustaining it, which,
yeah,
is interesting.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, dive in from your perspective of what this means and what you're trying to help people accomplish or just understand.
Yeah. So let's face it, our country is very heavily AA. And I love them. I've used them. I have referred many, many people to AA. But the United States as a whole is very strongly AA. So we have adapted culturally this idea that drinking is bad. It's kind of like the bad guy. But we still all drink. You know, it's gotten this idea. And the statistics support, you know, there's a lot of scary statistics about people dying from drinking. But what's not in the conversation is, since we have this sort of demonized idea of alcohol, but we still all participate, or many of us do, mm-hmm. 30% of people never drink, believe it or not.
Wow,
they have no
30%.
Interest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But 70% of people do.
Right.
And they drink to various levels. So since 70% of us are dancing with the bad guy, I think what we need to put on the table is this idea that, since so many of us enjoy alcohol, how can we enjoy this without labeling, without calling it a disease, without demonizing it? Because we use it to celebrate, we use it to commiserate, we use it for many, many reasons. It's a sacred drink, it's culturally and historically a sacred drink. Mm-hmm. And so to just demonize it and say that all these people die and, you know, it's associated with these diseases, which are all true, I'm not minimizing that. But what I want to bring to the conversation is this idea that if it is bad, but we enjoy it, how do we find that middle ground where we know that we're consuming enough to enjoy our lives, or enjoy have a nice glass of wine with dinner, or toast a wedding, or a bar mitzvah, or a baptism, or, you know, a toast to an old friend who died. Many people do a shot of whiskey in commemoration of an old buddy that used to golf with them or something, you know. In order to do that, and do that in a healthy way, and still include alcohol in our lives without demonizing it, we need to sit down and have that thoughtful consideration of how much is healthy and how much is not. Because how many of us know how many drinks is too many, and how many, except by our own personal experience of it. And for some people, that's really high, and for some people, that's really low. So we're not talking about healthy drinking. We're talking about dangerous drinking.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
So, like the law of attraction, what you think about, you bring about. So if I'm just going to talk about the nasty, terrible statistics and the bad aspects of it and why we shouldn't drink and the dangers of drinking, I'm thinking about it, I'm bringing it about. In other words, don't think about a pink elephant. There your mind is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what if instead we talk about what's healthy drinking? And then if I'm focused on healthy drinking, then that's what I'm going to bring about, because I'm thinking about how much I want to drink, how much I want to include in my diet, and it becomes the focus of healthy living rather than the dangers of this thing that I want to do anyway.
Right. And perhaps the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the norm, because we have a very black and white viewpoint because we're abstinence-based culture,
mm-hmm.
because of the strong underpinnings from AA. This moderation management business is not really appreciated nor liked. The woman who first came up with moderation management was Audrey Kishline, and unfortunately her story took a really terrible turn after she started moderation management. The underpinnings are pretty solid. Unfortunately, she was an alcoholic and she returned to drinking and ended up having a terrible accident where she was killed, and so were the people in the accident.
Oh.
And so it's been that idea of moderation management then became sort of a wash. It was publicized, and it's like, no, this doesn't work. Let's go back to the model of either you're an alcoholic or you're not, either you drink or you don't. But this middle ground of people who are non-alcoholic drinkers, the casual drinker, if you may, is the skeptical portion of society, but I think it's the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're not talking about what most people do.
Right. Well, we're seeing that the accidents, the dangerous, the bad stuff gets highlighted, and that's what,
like, for instance, for the new statistics now, 88,000 people a year die of alcohol-related deaths, fatalities, and so forth. 62,000 of them are men. 26,000 of them are women. That's a lot of people. Now, in a population of, you know, 306 million, I think we are now, you know, statistically, it's not that big a deal. But if it's your family member, 88,000 people, that's a gigantic crowd. That's a lot of people. And various ways to die from alcohol, not just acute, you know, you get drunk, you fall. By the way, falling is the way people die drinking, not car accidents. You'd think car accidents were first, but usually it's a fatal fall downstairs or out of a boat or in rocks, or because people do stupid things. And so the falls from those kind of things off a ladder, changing a light bulb, people will fall And that's the number one cause of alcohol-related deaths. And then secondly is fatal car crashes.
Okay.
When I found that out, I'm like, well, that's really strange. And then it happened, this was many years ago, I had a client whom I totally loved, and she ended up falling down a flight of stairs, and she also fell and died. And so it became like, oh, this is real, which also happened with her brother. And then since then, I've just learned a lot of other people who actually just fall and die because they hit their head. Usually it's trauma. So that being, keeping in mind, we always talk about what's excessive drinking, right? So the CDC has certain levels of drinking. For men, it's not to exceed 14 drinks. So if you drink 15 drinks or more, you're a heavy drinker. So I like this note, instead of being dependent or abuse or alcoholic, they use, are you a mild, moderate, or heavy drinker? Which I like that because it's a less stigmatic label, right?
Yep.
So there are many people who are heavy drinkers that are not dependent on alcohol. It's not to say that they won't become dependent. It depends on where they are in their trajectory of development of this condition, right? So, and then there are mild and moderate and heavy. So for men, it's 14 drinks. That's the max a week allowed by the CDC. For women, it's 7 drinks a week. However, they suggest not more than 3 drinks per occasion for men and not more than 2 drinks per occasion for women.
Okay.
So it's very, very easy. Say you're a woman in your 40s and you like a glass of wine, and you may come home from work and have one glass of wine, and that's 5 days a week. So you're at 5 there. And say you have a wedding this weekend or a barbecue or some, you're going to the cabin and you're going to take some beer and you're going to take some wine and maybe some friends are going to come. You may start having a drink at noon, right? And you might just nurse that drink from noon until dinner time. And then you aren't drunk, but you're drinking. And then you have this barbecue, and maybe after the barbecue, you know, you light the fire and you have this campfire thing going on. The kids are playing and you're watching and you're nursing a beer. You may end up having 4 or 5 beers over the course of 5 or 6 hours and not really feel it. Well, if you're having that and you've already had your 5, you're at 10 for the week, and boom, you're way over. You're considered a heavy drinker, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that you have to do this every single week. And what we're seeing now is because of the push to have people understand the dangers of drinking, people may start drinking, as you said, less often, but when they do, they binge. Mm-hmm. So binging, drinking 5 or more drinks on any given occasion. And this is of concern because it's all about blood alcohol volume. When you reach levels that are dangerous, and of course we know that anything over 0.05 becomes impairment. Legally, it's 0.08 for a DWI, or, you know, to get a ticket or get arrested for driving anything, even apparently a Barco lounger.
Mm.
Right? A famous chair here. So when you get to levels of impairment, then you start to have body changes. And that's what I'm here to talk about. It's about what happens when we overdrink, when we are heavy drinkers, over time with the body. Regardless of what alcohol is doing to you to get you intoxicated or get a buzz or whatever, it is having effects on your body long term. And of course, we know with what alcohol does and the damage it does to your body, it ages you more quickly. It can cause all kinds of changes to your homeostasis, or your healthy level of being. It can change your liver, your kidneys, your stomach, your esophagus, your brain. You know, it's associated with a lot of different problems when you're, physical problems when you're, and psychological problems when you're a heavy drinker. So I would like people to know, what are healthy levels of drinking and how do I manage that? Because the nature of alcohol itself, the demon rum, if you will, you know, has its own agenda. So it's set up, when alcohol enters the body, it's set up to make us more thirsty. It's a diuretic. So the more we drink, the more we want to drink. And we're used to having that glass in our hand, right? Mm-hmm. So just by nature of that. And as soon as you put alcohol in the body, it will change the brain. So it changes your ability to have free choice to choose to drink more or less. So once you get intoxicated, the idea of stopping becomes almost impossible for the brain due to the circulation changes in the prefrontal cortex. So you really don't have that option to say no over time. And so that was in a movie by Kevin McCauley. That's a doctor, Kevin McCauley, and he talks about this theory of addiction that has to do with usurping or taking away the free will in a condition called hypofrontality. Now, that's a lot of information. Basically, let's make it simple. Heavy drinking leads to this condition called hypofrontality, which is reduced circulation in the brain. and the most important part of the brain, your prefrontal cortex, which is right behind your in your forehead, right? So it takes away your ability to say, no, I don't want to drink. That's when it becomes more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Can you define, because I know this came up in college, and this comes up in conversations way after college, what is a drink? What is one drink?
One drink. One drink is defined as 5 ounces of wine, 1 12-ounce beer, but not the microbrews because they will have more in them, right? They will have a higher alcohol concentration, or a shot to a shot and a half of distilled liquor. Okay. So a drink is a drink is a drink, and those are equal. So, for instance, a bottle of wine has 5 drinks in it.
Okay.
Your typical 750, it has 5 drinks in it.
Okay.
Yeah, and 1 12-ounce beer is one drink. And one shot, or one mixed drink, if you will, is a drink. So those things are...
Right, cool. And I'm thinking of times that I have had or seen somebody order wine in a restaurant, and a lot of times...
Way overboard.
Yeah, they're getting a lot. Or if you get it at a party, you get a wine glass instead of sort of that... part of the wine. Is it the half the wine glass?
It's usually
glass?
About one. It depends on the size of the wine glass, but it's usually, if it's a big wine glass, it's maybe a third of the glass. If it's medium, it's half. And if it's a small wine glass, it can go up 2/3 of the way. It just depends on the ounces in the glass. Right. So you see already there.
Right.
And if you go to just about any restaurant and they have tap beer, they're going to ask what size you want. And you can go from a 12-ounce, 16, 22. Like, so if you think 22-ounce beer, that's like, okay, I'm going to have dinner. Many people sit down and have a 22-ounce beer. That's already 2 drinks right there.
Right.
In one glass.
And that's then you get pitchers.
Yeah.
And you keep them coming.
And you don't
keep
track.
And you're not paying attention.
No. And then you'll refill your glass because it may be getting warm when it's half full or to third full. And then so you don't know how many.
Right.
You don't know. You can only know by how drunk you're getting.
Right. Right. Which then you kind of lose your ability to figure out over time.
And that ability to figure out is that hypofrontality kicking in.
Right.
Isn't that interesting?
It
so the nature of the beast is that it's meant to confuse you and keep you drinking it. Because the more you drink it, the more you want, the more you want, the more you drink it. And over time, as you keep consuming, as we've seen there, that this is a condition that develops. And so the longer you do it, the more tolerance you have, and the more you're going to consume, and the more effect it's going to have on you. And pretty soon you can become dependent. And then it does turn into alcoholism, and it does turn into this dependent state. Over time, it will happen.
Right. So you've kind of talked about the how many drinks, where that limit is.
Yeah, where that limit is.
Where is the optimal health on that limit? Because, I mean, some would argue 0 is good and best. And some would say, no, health, it's not bad. A few isn't bad, or it might even have some benefits with red wine and things like that. So how do we balance that out and think about that in a healthy way?
In a healthy way. Well, Dr. Daniel Amen has done a lot of work in brain scans and alcoholism and looked at what alcohol does to the brain. So he recommends, and I agree with him, for men, 2 to 3 drinks a day, not more than 1 or 2 days a week. So the most a man should have to maintain healthy, good brain health without kicking in the addictive or I want more or it becoming a habit that grows from being Friday, Saturday to Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and let's fill in the Thursday, and now I've got a hangover on Monday morning. Instead of it growing, the way to not have this consumption increase over time is to stick to those levels. So men, 2 or 3 drinks a day, not more than 1 or 2 days a week, and you cannot stack them. In other words, it's not a weekly count, it's a daily count, right? Mm-hmm. So if men can have a total per week of 6, you can't stack and not drink all week and then drink 6 one day.
Gotcha.
Because now you're binging, and that's a problem.
Right.
Right? Because now you're taking on those changes, those liver changes, the kidneys, the esophagus, the stomach. Now you're starting to damage your body if you're drinking, binge drinking.
Right. And define, if you can, binge drinking. Because I'm thinking somebody might say, well, there's the times I have the 6 drinks or the 10 drinks in an evening, hanging out with my friends. And then there's but if I have 6 drinks, but I start at 8 in the morning and I drink until midnight.
Yeah. We keep it simple in a day.
Right.
Five in a day, more than five in a day. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
So for women, the same, it's a little bit different. For women, it's one or two drinks a day, not more than 1 or 2 days a week. So all week, you're to keep your brain healthy and not start to compromise it, not more than four in a week, and you cannot stack them all in one day and drink four, you know, like at the wedding.
Right.
So it's much lower levels than the CDC, 14 as compared to 6 for men and 7 as compared to 4 for women. So it's a much lower amount, because if I'm only 5 feet tall and I weigh about 125 pounds, if I were to drink every day, I would naturally, because of the nature of alcohol, I would naturally want to drink more than one over time on one of those days. And then that would become 2, 3, 4, and pretty soon that would just grow, it just begin to mushroom if I kept allowing that. If I didn't be aware about healthy levels of drinking, then
right,
it would just take on its own. The other thing I need, because you mentioned earlier, is the college drinking thing. There's something that I have personally been aware of for, you know, counseling for 11 years, and that is phase-related drinking. However, I've not found any references to phase-related drinking in the literature. We do have event-related drinking and late-onset drinking, which are usually associated with an event. For instance, if you lose your job, if your spouse dies, if you lose a house, if you have a bankruptcy, people can start drinking to cope with this awful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be event-related drinking. Phase-related drinking, as I've seen it, has to do with the phase of life that you're in. Often, I grew up in the 80s or 70s. Ages me. I grew up in the 70s in, you know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where beer drinking started in 10th grade.
Mm.
So phase related, as kids, you know, would go out to the local national parks and consume a keg of beer, which was keggers, you know, and that was quite normal. The phase was in 10th, 11th, 12th grade. You start kind of getting initiated into the use of alcohol, and then you may get some sickness. You might drink too much and, you know, get nauseated and throw up and have the hangover the next day and, you know, not feel good. And so that's your initiation into it. And that was really quite normal for baby boomers. That wasn't like the taboo it is today. So in the 70s, things were a little different. And then as we go through college, typically that's another time when people get introduced to drinking. And as people go through college, there are the big college, you know, the dorm parties, if they're allowed, the park parties, the dances, the houses when they move into, you know, their own little houses instead of in the dorms,
mm-hmm.
and not to mention the fraternities and sororities and all that partying that goes on there that, you know, there's movies about because it's notorious,
right?
So there's phase-related drinking. Now, with that, if you have exposure in your youth to drinking, it's far easier to get involved in the drinking culture in the college. If not, it's sometimes a novelty, but you can still get really engaged in that drinking culture. And I think for kids, they feel, like you said, there's more binging and less, you know, daily drinking, because we're, you know, studying all week and then we got to party hardy on the weekends kind of thing. And then because it's like, you know, there's no planned drinking, we just know we're going to a party, but I'm not counting my drinks or telling myself how many I want to use. What happens is I get operant conditioning. Stimulus, just like Pavlov's dog, right? So there's a party coming up this weekend. Oh boy, oh boy! And then I get all dressed up. I get ready. I might have a drink with the girls or two before the party to kind of relax or not feel anxiety, because I'm going to meet a lot of new people. And then we go to the party and we're all friendly and we start to know people and we carry that, you know, the notorious red plastic cup with whatever's in there. You know,
or the Nalgene.
Yeah.
That's what came up at UMD. UMD has an alcohol health educator who's amazing. She's amazing. She can get the kids to talk about anything. And she just has that personality about her, and she's very friendly and non-judgmental, and it's a beautiful thing. It's discussions are fantastic. But she talked about, you know, the whole, had this person in for alcohol poisoning, and, you know, well, how many drinks did you have? Well, I had one. And then finally figured out they were drinking out of an LG.
Bottle.
I was like, well, wait a minute,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, if it's 25 ounces, yeah, one drink is not one drink,
right.
For sure. Yeah.
Right.
So it's perception. And so with that phase-related drinking then in college, because there's classic traditional almost initiation part of college for some that includes the drinking piece. I have counseled many college students who have been drinking since their, say, their freshman year, and now they're seniors and they're getting ready to enter the workforce. And really that conversation is all about, is this pattern of drinking going to work for you when you start working, mm-hmm. you know, a 9-to-5 job in, or 8-to-6, or I guess it's more like 7-to-9 now. So is that going to work? And certainly if you're going to go off and be a high school teacher, that level of drinking isn't going to work. So often we see a drop in the level of consumption when people start working, get established, start having bills to pay, get married or get in a stable relationship, start having children. So then you have that family building phase, and then the drinking doesn't pick up again usually until the children are a little bit more independent and they have a little bit more money or affluence, and then it may start up again. So there are phases throughout life where we have more drinking and less drinking. And we're seeing something new with the baby boomers. Those were people born from 1947 to 1964, the baby boomers. They're huge. After the war, babies were born, and so these people are aging. The youngest one today is 54, and the oldest one is in their 79, I think it would be. And so those people are returning to, because now they're usually affluent, they've had good jobs, they're starting to have some more free time, no children are around, they have boats and they have second houses, and you know, they have the money to go ahead, and they become wine connoisseurs. What we're seeing then also with event related, if they lose a spouse or their economic situation changes, or they have to downsize, or they move where they're living because their children are somewhere and they want to live closer to the children, whatever, big change is happening. What we're seeing is return to prescription drug and wine use. That's really super common in affluent women. And we're also seeing a return to marijuana use, because that was a thing in the 60s and 70s, and so they stopped using for a large period of time, and now they're going back to playing with marijuana because, oh, it's good for you, and there's all these health benefits, which, not for smoking marijuana with the THC, however, the CBD oils, that's a whole other conversation, do have some health benefits. The other thing we're seeing is the rate of admission for older men. The fastest growing population is at rates of admission to residential or inpatient treatment of Caucasian men 65 and older for heroin use. That's the fastest growing group of people who are filling up treatment centers now. You would think it might be the youth culture kids who are getting into it, or the 20-somethings because their consumption rates are higher, but actually we're seeing more admittance for people over 65 with heroin use. Wow. So why is that? As we age, we have pain. We have, you know, things that start, and we go to the doctor, we may sustain injuries, old injuries from our crazy youth. We'll start to get arthritic. So we go to get pain management treatment. And often about 10% of people who are prescribed opiates will become addicted to them. And actually everyone will. And it's a matter of how long you're on them and how dedicated you are to getting off them, knowing, you know, the dangers of being on opiates. Mm-hmm. So what's happening with these group of people that are over 65, and that's the growing group of people, right. And that is, you get on pain meds, you abuse them, you get taken off your pain med contract, you look for it in another direction, and that can be through, you know, black market, on the streets, you find a dealer for pills, somehow, you know, they get onto the streets, that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
So you start taking pills that are not prescribed to you. Mm-hmm. Over time, they become difficult to afford because it's expensive. Pharmaceuticals, even on the street, are expensive. Right. And it's far cheaper to use heroin. Someone will gladly show you how to use it if they want to sell it to you.
Right.
And then you find yourself being, you know, 67 years old, addicted to heroin.
Right.
How did this happen?
Right. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of the fallout of the opiate.
Sure. Yeah, that is a complex situation.
Yeah.
And how, yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah.
So that's a whole other addiction.
Right,
area. But
right.
So back to drinking here. Safe levels of drinking. How do I manage that? So let's talk a little bit. I wanted to bring to attention this book called Paying the Tab by Philip J. Cook. It's really quite interesting because in there they talk about number of drinks per week. So even though the CDC allows 7 drinks a week for women, 14 for men, if we look at that over the course of a year, just for fun here, I found this really interesting. So the top 30% of people are problem drinkers. Okay, and let's look at how that varies. So if you're going to drink 2 drinks a week on average, just about 2 drinks a week on average, okay, then you're drinking 8 or 9 drinks a month. right?
Okay.
So far that sounds pretty doable. Mm-hmm. But what becomes really interesting is, as I look at this in terms of, say, bottles of wine, mm-hmm. I'm drinking about 2 bottles of wine a month.
Okay.
Right? And if I'm going to drink 0.8, I'm going to finish that bottle. So let's say I'm drinking 2 bottles of wine a month. That ends up being 22 bottles to 24 bottles a year that I'm drinking. That's 2 cases of wine. Mm-hmm. So if you look at it, I'm drinking 2 cases of wine, it suddenly starts to look like that's more than I thought I was drinking, right? It's 113 drinks a year, which this is really low-level drinking. So if we move that up a little bit and start to get into the problem drinking area, what we see is that people will have maybe 6 drinks a week or more, 6 or 7, if we're looking at the CDC level, right? Then we're drinking at least a bottle or more a week. And that turns into a month, about 5 or 6 bottles a month that we're drinking. This is at the CDC recommended levels, right? And at the end of the year, if we look at how many bottles of wine, that adds up to 65 bottles of wine a year. So now we're talking about many, many, many cases of, and that's the CDC recommended level.
Right.
So that's really a lot of consumption in terms of brain health. So the difference between the mild drinker of 2 or 3 drinks a week, right, mm-hmm. where you're drinking maybe 2 cases of wine a year, mm-hmm. to the next level where you're drinking about a bottle a week, you're now drinking 65 cases. There's a far cry between, you know, 2 cases and 65 bottles.
Right.
You know.
Right. And I'm thinking the CDC level. So remind me what that's kind of their top end of what you should be.
So for men, that's
okay.
14 drinks
right.
a week, and for women, that's 7 drinks a week. So if you're drinking at that rate, you're drinking in excess of 65 bottles. I use wine because it's easy to refer.
Right.
So it's like 65 bottles of wine
right.
a year,
right.
which is...
And they're saying if you're at that level, that is a problem.
They're
like
saying
above that level,
above that level, it's a problem.
Okay.
But if you look at
getting close to that level, it's a lot of alcohol.
It's a lot of alcohol. And if you're looking at brain health, it's mm-hmm. far less. It's about 2 cases a year.
Okay. So that's an interesting
bottles.
Distinction.
Yes.
That's sometimes I think it's interesting when we talk about recommended daily or these top levels, it's about somebody looks at those numbers and goes, I can have.
Yes.
I can have that many and I'm okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I heard a guy about vitamins, but it's still an interesting point. The guy saying, you know, we talk about recommended daily allowances and make sure that you get those. Those are just to keep you alive. Those are not to help you be a thriving human being.
Yeah.
That is so you don't die.
Yeah.
And we don't understand, and we're not even told and really made clear, this is what these numbers mean. So
yes.
somebody looks at the CDC
and says,
that's my range. That's my freedom range,
yeah.
right?
Yes.
And that's not the numbers to sustain health. That's just the numbers to not be considered in a label.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's perfect. I couldn't have said it better. So that's right. And so if you want to have healthy drinking and you want to sustain, be able to enjoy a glass of wine or some beer or a gin and tonic, for instance, till you're in your 80s, then you have to look at, okay, this is an activity I really enjoy. So in order to not have to get into trouble with it, sustain brain changes, get cancer or liver cirrhosis or kidney failure or pancreatitis or all the other things that can happen, or worse yet, get in a car accident, kill myself, kill somebody else, lose my house, my family. There are terrible things that can happen when you are a heavy drinker. So in order to say, well, I really like this and I'd like to continue doing this, then you look at what is healthy for my brain, where I'm not going to cause damage to the body, I'm not going to cause damage to the brain, and I can do this in a helpful way. And I'm personally, as a therapist and counselor and a coach, I think the levels of 7 to 14 are high.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're high. And so if we look at Dr. Daniel Amen's recommendations that are 6 to 4, 6 for men, 4 for women, then we're looking at what can keep your brain healthy. And he's all about brain health.
Right.
So they also go into diet and exercise and the things we can eat and the supplementation and all the things we can do to promote brain health. Because as Dr. Daniel Amen says, size matters when it comes to your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you can enjoy a glass of wine. You just can't enjoy 10 of them in one night.
Right.
Because then it becomes that addictive pattern. And then the demon rum, you know, then gets to have its way with you, where it takes away your ability to decide to stop. and starts to create brain changes, which make it pretty impossible to stop that slippery slope.
So the brain, let's just, and you kind of said this, but I just kind of want to revisit it a little bit. So I'm thinking of the person who's like, I really don't drink very much, but when I do, maybe even once a year, it's usually a special occasion, and that's when I'm not paying so much attention. So I know that, yes, I definitely know I'm going over my daily limit, but I'm only doing that once every so often. Mm-hmm. So definitely there's the impairment piece that comes from not being able to think clearly about how many you're having. But what other changes or damage can you do in just that one session, even if it's infrequent?
Even if it's just Easter, 4th of July, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, and New Year's. You drink five times a year. Or maybe it's just your New Year's Eve, you know, bash or whatever. We call it what it's called, amateur night, right? Culturally, we talk about that. So what's the problem with binge drinking? It has all to do with the blood alcohol concentration. So that's why we talk about drinking in terms of a day, how much you can have in a day. And it doesn't matter if that drinking day happens once a year or twice a week. It's still in the day that you're doing your counting. Mm-hmm. So when you exceed, and the smaller you are, the more effect it will have. But when you exceed the binge levels, recommendations, for me, five, if I had five drinks, I would be so sick I couldn't function for days afterwards, because I'm only 125 pounds. I'm a small person. But say for someone who's, you know, 6'4" with an athletic build and a man, a bit, five might not seem like very much to him, right? Because there's a different volume of blood in his body than there is in mine, not even taken in consideration of age. And as we age, our blood volume goes down. So the key to successful or drinking that you can sustain has to do with your daily intake, which for women shouldn't exceed 2, and for men shouldn't exceed 3, right? Because here's what happens. After you exceed those levels, then you get intoxicated. Within that word is toxin, right? Mm-hmm. Intoxicate. So alcohol is a toxicant. It's a toxin to the body. It's a poison, in other words, to the body. So when it goes into the body, it causes damage like any other poison would do. It's just it tends to be really pleasant on its way on its way to poisoning us, right? Alcohol is fat soluble, so it crosses the blood-brain barrier and starts causing really big changes in the brain. So it will affect your primary control center, which is your amygdala and your midbrain. And what it will do, it will kick in a reward response that is a hyper response to an event. So if something's particularly good, the brain will go, oh my God, that is so wonderful. We need to remember to do this again and again because it felt so good. So it's a kick above the normal thing. For instance, if you've been working all day out in the cold, we're in Minnesota, winter, shoveling the drive, and we come in and we're cold and we take a hot shower, that is sometimes the best hot shower you've ever had, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've been cold. And so the dopamine hit there is really high. But when you come to addictive drugs and alcohol, the payoff when you use that is much higher than just your ordinary, you know, taking a hot shower or eating a good steak dinner. Or the payback in dopamine is much higher. So the brain remembers this was really good, let's do it again. The initial payoff is a lot better. So it affects your brain, right? And over time, it will reduce the circulation in the brain, especially to the prefrontal cortex. And not just for the time that you're drunk. But Mother Nature is slow in putting back that circulation. So it will reduce the circulation by less than 15% to the vital areas that are used for analyzing, remembering, problem solving, making sense of people's faces and communication. So that part of your brain that makes you human, that 10%, really gets shut down and shut off because Mother Nature says, oh, wait a minute, I'm not going to let you poison me. I'm going to protect you by withdrawing the circulation, thereby exposing the brain to less of the toxin. It's protecting itself. But when it gives back the circulation, it doesn't mean it comes fully back after your hangover's over. It takes weeks for one binge to resolve itself in the body because Mother Nature's slow to allowing that back because it doesn't want to be exposed to that toxin. So that's the first thing. The second thing is if you're drinking, especially hard liquor, when you take a drink, it burns. It burns because it's a significant dehydration substance. It dehydrates you and it takes away that mucus membrane that's covering your entire GI, your entire digestive system. Right. Yep. So the esophagus has the mucous membrane, the mucus layer that protects all the cells. And when you drink alcohol, it rips that protective layer off. It starts to dehydrate, and very quickly, those very sensitive little cells that are on the little cilia that are in your esophagus, and before you know it, you have breakage, you have some damage, the scar tissue. Scar tissue leads to proliferation of tissue, which in layman's terms, we call that tumors. Right? So the more studies that are done with alcohol and cancer, we're finding that because of this effect and also the toxicity that is actually the alcohol, we're having much higher incidence of cancer. And that's throughout the whole digestive tract. So it gets your stomach. It does the same thing. It changes your biosphere in your intestines. So it takes away all your normal flora, changes your normal flora. Those normal flora, we also know, are associated when you start to change them. They can produce substances that will make you crave alcohol, that will get you depressed. The normal flora that you have will actually produce a substance which will actually make you want to drink more alcohol. So it's asking for more. It'll enhance your cravings. It can also cause depression. There's a huge link between bacteria in your gut and depression and anxiety. And so all of this starts to add together. So once it gets all through that, then we're associated with colon cancers and all of that. And not to mention, once the alcohol, because it's fat soluble, it gets into the bloodstream, and now it's a free-for-all. The alcohol goes to absolutely every organ in the body. And because when the liver breaks down alcohol into its components, one of them becomes glucose over time, it kicks in the pancreas to produce insulin. And then you can have pancreatitis, inflammation of the pancreas for some people if it's an overload for their system. And then because your liver has to keep up with breaking it down, it gets worked and overworked and can't keep up. And then it starts to have cirrhosis, signs of fatty acid or lipid deposits. And so there are many things that can happen with that. You can also, your body can also store the excess calories as fat on the body. So you'll see people with a big beer gut. It's not really that they're pregnant. It's that they're storing all that excess calories that they're taking in fat in the body. And so that will give that appearance of almost being pregnant when you're not, because men don't generally have babies. Right? So there's that. And so it contributes to insulin resistance, if not can be associated with diabetes. That's another thing. For some people, it can precipitate seizures, especially on the way out with withdrawal, because alcohol is dangerous when you cut it off really quickly. If you are at high levels on a daily basis, if you suddenly stop for 72 hours, you need to go to a detox unit. Oh, wow. Because they need to put you on a medication so you do not seizure.
Right.
I've had clients in my care that have never had a seizure disorder until they started drinking daily, and then they had to stop. They had to stop due to all the other problems that come with it, and they would have a seizure, and now they have a seizure disorder, and they have to be on medications for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
And that doesn't happen for everybody. But
right, for sure.
Yeah, but so it can precipitate a lot of different things. So when we get into these levels of heavy drinking, we're asking for a whole multitude of things that are not healthy. So to stay in that healthy, green, organic, leave no footprint, holistic, healthy eating, you know, whole grains and organic vegetables, and reducing our consumption of things that aren't good for us, or eating grass-fed beef instead and chickens that haven't been treated with antibiotics and all that. As we embrace this whole healthy lifestyle, more walking, more clear water, that kind of thing, if we still want to enjoy a glass of wine, here's what we can do. One is always plan drinking, right? So you know your levels, what's safe for you. And if you go over that 4 drinks a week by 1 or 2, that's not going to kill you. However, that's not something you want to do repeatedly over time and let it get away from you, right? You want to keep coming back to those levels that are more healthy for you. Because if we look in the end at this category, the people in the top 10% of drinking, that really heavy drinkers, are out consuming most people a great deal. They're drinking all day and they're drinking a lot. They're drinking 73 drinks a week on average, which is like 14 bottles of wine
week. Wow.
Right? So if you look at that and extrapolate that all through the whole year, they're drinking in excess of 750 bottles of wine a year. And so if most people aren't drinking like a set number of drinks per day, some days they'll have fewer, other days they'll have more. Depends on, you know, businessmen are at risk, construction workers are at risk, people with high stress jobs are at risk, because It's the straight line between stress and being non-stressed. So we use it to manage stress. 90% of all doctor visits are to deal with things with stress, right? Mm-hmm. So what we need to do is learn to manage our stress in other ways and enjoy alcohol as a beverage to enhance a meal or to celebrate a wedding or a birthday or whatever, but not something that we're going to go off and drink bottles and bottles and exceed what's recommended for brain health and brain changes.
Right. And so, like you said, it's a toxin.
All by itself, it's a toxin, right. Yeah. And so what we can do is plan our drinking. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Know our levels, know our safe levels, and stick to those, right? And so long as I plan my drinking 24 hours in advance, I'm not going to kick in this operant conditioning in terms of having it be a default or an automatic response to what's going on in my day. Mm-hmm. So we want to avoid something called brownouts. And a lot of people haven't heard what a brownout is. And that is when you're fully conscious, you're not drinking, and you're not drunk in any way, but somehow you find yourself drinking at the end of the day when you didn't have an intention or a plan. Mm-hmm. You just realize, I said I wasn't going to drink today, but oh, look, it's 8 o'clock and I'm having a drink. How did that happen? I've had clients in my past that have talked about a brownout being, I'm at home and I'm thinking about drinking. And before I know it, I'm drinking. I'm sitting on the corner and I'm having a drink. I went down to the liquor store and they'll be telling, I remember putting on my socks and shoes going, I'm not going to drink today. And they put on their jacket, I'm not going to drink today. And they grab some money and I'm not going to drink today. And they're out the door, walking down the sidewalk to the liquor store, telling themselves, no, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And before you know it, everything just clicks into automatic pilot and they end up drinking. And that's the nature of drinking. We will have brownouts because it's such an efficient and effective antidote to stress. So instead of taking the time to figure out what else can I do, whether that's meditate, take a walk, lie down for a bit, do some deep breathing, do some yoga, color, listen to music, watch, I know, for me as a kid, it was Gilligan's Island, right? Watch some old TV, whatever it is. Do something else to, what I like to say, is come up for air. Mm-hmm. Because we're not doing that. We're just going straight from work to dinner and a drink or whatever.
Right.
And we're not pausing for a moment, coming up for air and saying, oh, I'm done. Now I can shift my mindset and go into the home and be more present and have more fun and all that.
Right. Kind of thing. Right.
So rather than labeling alcoholism, if we look at it in terms of mild, moderate, or heavy drinking, if we are moderate or heavy drinkers, we can start looking at what does it mean to be mild, because that's more sustainable over the long run. You're much more likely, if you moderate your drinking now, you can still be drinking at 80. If you don't, you may not even be alive to have a glass of wine when you're 80.
Right. Wow. So one of the thoughts I'm thinking about when you were talking about how much alcohol is been shrinking, and I'm thinking about what we get in the restaurants and that kind of thing. So having a Long Island iced tea, that's pretty much a binge drink.
That's three
right
drinks
there.
Right.
So
three
yeah.
or four, depending on how they make their Long Island.
So right, and that's the thing I'm thinking about. If somebody's really paying attention to, is it okay to like ask the bartender, whoever's making, you know, how many servings of alcohol are in this?
Yeah.
And just to get that idea and keep that, so you know what you can have if you want to keep that
healthy
safety
living
aspect.
If you're going to ask for gluten-free and organic and all that, why not ask how many shots are in your drink or and pay attention to how many ounces are in your wine glass. And, you know, if you're drinking that 22-ounce beer, you know, because it's happy hour, keeping track of that makes as much sense as keeping track of all the other things.
Right.
If you're going to be healthy, well, let's be healthy.
Right, exactly. All around, and it's, but it, yeah, in society, it's just gotten to be so mindless, kind of.
Yes.
That it's just what you do, in a sense. And we're all trying to figure out and how to rein those pieces in.
Yeah.
With the restaurant's goal is to sell you more liquor. The bar's goal is to sell you more liquor.
The manufacturer's
goal is to sell you more liquor.
And
so,
alcohol itself is a substance that naturally causes you to want more of it.
It's a great gig they got going.
It's a great gig, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So two other thoughts come to mind. And the thought of combining alcohol and energy drinks.
Oh, danger.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So there's such a thing as direct and indirect effects of substances that we consume. So if we're drinking alcohol, it's generally a central nervous system depressant. And so what goes down must come up. Mother Nature will right itself by pouring into the system stimulant chemicals that are your own natural chemicals, right? Your own natural brain chemicals in order to bring you back to this balance of homeostasis, right? So when you put some alcohol into the system, it'll artificially bring it down. And then you're over the course of the night, your body will kick in to bring you back into balance. And it'll overshoot a little bit because you've been too low, right? So it's bringing you back up. So the resultant effect is agitation, nervousness, nausea, shakes. That's what we call withdrawal or hangover, a headache. A headache is actually withdrawal, right? That's part of that. So if you're drinking a stimulant, like a lot of caffeine in the day, Red Bull and those caffeinated, really highly caffeinated charging drinks, right? Mm-hmm. If you're drinking those, or if you're going into hard drugs like cocaine or methamphetamines, those are stimulants, right? So it'll take you from homeostasis and your level balance way of being, and it'll bring you that hyper awareness. It'll make you feel awake and alive, and it'll stimulate your nervous system. So it's a central nervous system stimulant. As in all things, Mother Nature wants to write that. So it's going to dump chemicals in there to bring you back down and bring you back to that level of homeostasis. The problem is, as alcohol depresses your nervous system, you have a masking effect from the stimulant that allows you to drink more. You would otherwise pass out by now and stop drinking. And that's what passing out is. Mother Nature says, you will stop. Mm-hmm. I'll make you stop. And here's how I'm going to pass you out flat on the ground. And therefore, you're not going to drink anymore, right? Because Mother Nature wants to keep you alive. That's the way it works. Your body is naturally made to survive. So it'll stop you that way. But the problem with stimulants is that they'll mask the effect of the depressant and you'll be able to drink more. Unfortunately, you'll drink more for a longer period of time and it'll be masked so that you can get to lethal doses of alcohol much more quickly. And you won't have the, I'm going to pass out at your threshold, you'll be passing out later. And when you do, if you've been out drinking that, your friends better have a mirror or be an EMT or somebody who knows how to check for life signs, because when people go down, they need to be checked if they're breathing, because what it does, depressing the central nervous system enough, will shut off your respiratory center, so you'll stop breathing.
Wow.
And then eventually your heart, right, because you need to breathe.
Right.
So that's the problem, and that's why in most bars, especially in Wisconsin, ironically, I used to own bars in Wisconsin early, many years ago, and so there's a limit on how much you can sell one client in one visit.
Okay.
In terms of how many they can have. They can have one or maybe two, and then they can't have any more, because you never want to put someone in a position of depressing their central nervous system.
Right.
To the point where they won't wake up.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it both are artificial. So you're bringing it down and you're bringing it up, and the body's going, wait, what's going on here?
Yeah. And so then you'll have the added, you know, the agitation and then the sluggishness for the hangover the next day. It's just a bad combination. In fact, they used to, in California, they made some products that never made it to the Midwest that were alcohol with stimulants right in the can that you were drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a lot of trouble with that. This was years ago, and I think it was in the 80s in California. And they had so much trouble that they banned the product, and we never saw it come to the Midwest.
Wow.
It was so dangerous.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The other question that comes to mind when you were talking about kids being introduced to alcohol, and I'm, you know, like you were saying, you kind of had, where you were, it was more of a drink a lot introduction to alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I know when I remember doing some research, and I can't remember, but I think I found data that kind of went a little bit both ways. But I'm thinking about not necessarily a huge introduction to alcohol where it's you're drinking a lot. And I'm thinking about the college students that I've heard who it was such a taboo that no, you weren't allowed to taste it. You were, you know, and they get to college and they're like, woohoo, I can do this, you know.
Almost like the Amish response.
right. And I'm curious to know, you know, what you kind of think about that and what you think about aspects of parenting and kids. The way I grew up, and I think this was a really, really awesome thing that my parents did, is they didn't make it taboo for me. So when I remember being in like second grade, and my dad was pouring the wine, and I got my little glass of wine, which as a kid, you know, when I was a kid, I was a weird kid. When I was a kid, the thing I didn't want to be was a kid. So to be able to be part of that, to be able to taste it, I tasted various different types of alcohol. So when I got to be drinking age, it was kind of like not that big of a deal. I didn't need to experience. I didn't need to rush out and see what all this was about. And for me, I feel like that was a huge benefit. It was a no big deal. Is that a good way to do things? Like, is that, because it felt to me, like I said, I felt like I was part of what was going on. It wasn't taken away. Somebody said, oh no, you can't have, I knew I couldn't have multiple drinks, but I got to have little tastes and got to know what was everybody else experiencing.
Yeah. Well, we know that we don't want to expose the brain early on to alcohol. So it's not something you want to go out of your way to do.
Right.
So that curiosity taste, for if you have alcoholic lineage, if you have alcoholism in your family, mm-hmm. tasting alcohol might be, the flashpoint or lighting a fuse for kids. But if you don't, taking away the brain loves novelty and variety. So even as children, we're curious about everything because everything's new and we want to see new things. And even today, if you look at your life, if you're not doing anything new or different, then you're going to get pretty bored because your brain really likes new and different.
Right.
So like you, my family also exposed me to alcohol. It was no big deal in the family. We had a liquor cabinet. Nobody cared. Nobody snuck. It was, who cares? Mm-hmm. Because that was the other thing. We were allowed, if my parents would entertain, which in the 70s they did, in the 80s, people had people over frequently. We were allowed to sit and listen to adult conversation. And if I wanted to taste my mother's wine, like in the kitchen or something, she'd say, okay, but I don't think you'll like it. So we just, I don't know.
Sounds familiar.
It was like, I didn't like it. But then alcoholism is not rampant in my family line. So it was definitely, it took the stigma out of it being a big deal for me, growing up. As a whole, and ethically speaking, we don't want to expose young brains to alcohol. Mm-hmm. Not a good idea. However, as a child gets older, if there are no alcoholic issues in the family and people are mild or moderate drinkers, taking away the stigma and the curiosity is certainly helpful. What you find is when kids have been absolutely raised in a very strict environment, they go hog wild on everything. It's not just alcohol. It's clothing. It's sex. It's let's just try everything, a whole smorgasbord of things, right? And so it's that rebellion. I got to find out what life's all about. And there can be a lot of really tragic consequences being that. But on the other hand, if we look at consumption in other countries, it's not the same as here either,
right?
I grew up French Canadian. My family is from Canada. And so the views on drinking being French are like, it's, wine is part of like eating bread.
Right?
And we all know how evil bread is. I had no fascination with it as a child. Like I was smelled whatever, but I don't recall my parents saying, no, you can't taste this, but they didn't encourage it. And I didn't get my own glass. That was something that didn't happen in my family. Mm-hmm. However, growing up, I did have a friend who would have spaghetti, and every time they had spaghetti, everybody would get a little glass of red wine. Unfortunately, that was an alcoholic household they were in, and so those ramifications, repeated over the years with the family members. But so it's about what is your history? Because genetics makes a difference, but that's only a third of the argument. The rest is, do I have exposure and is it socially acceptable? So if I had come from a family who's got alcoholic problems with drinking, and I never drink, I will never be an alcoholic because there's no exposure, regardless of genetics, right? But if I have the genetics and I have the exposure, then it depends on who I'm hanging with. What neighborhood am I in? Do I have to go to the local bar and watch the game and drink 27 beers to watch the Vikings or the Packers play,
Right.
Especially if they're playing together.
Right.
Oh, my God. Or do I live in a community or in an environment where nobody's really drinking, no one talks about it, and nobody really cares? Mm-hmm. So it's all about the social norms where you live, the exposure that you have, and also your background. So take in consideration all those three things.
Okay. So I'm thinking do you have any advice on what is the age of a child that you should, below this age, they shouldn't taste alcohol? It's just not good for their body.
Yeah. Well, 18 is the recommended, you shouldn't drink before you're 18. But if a parent is thinking that that's something that they aren't thinking it's a very big deal, I wouldn't expose my children before 16.
Okay.
It's just not good. If they're curious, they'll still be curious when they're 16.
Right.
But that doesn't mean I'm going to crack some beers and watch a Netflix with you when you're 15,
Well, and I'm thinking even just...
Yeah, if a child has a sip,
right,
just to see what it is.
Yep.
But also, bear in mind, that sip could also be lighting the fuse, right? So you have to really take a contextual look at the family situation, and if that seems to be something, certainly you're a parent who can make that decision, but that's not recommended.
Mm-hmm.
till you're 18.
Right.
Really.
And I'm thinking even like, I know this discussion came up with communion and yep. things like that.
Yeah, because there are some religious rites and stuff, right, mm-hmm. that go with that. And,
right.
And so that has to do with culture and society and religious beliefs and so forth. So we all still have the freedom of choice, right?
Right.
So,
right.
But the other thing is we want to look at when the brain develops, right? So between 0 and 6, you have what we call the hypnotic stage, slower brain waves, and the brain is just growing by leaps and bounds and taking in everything in an unfiltered way. So it's almost like children from 0 to 5, 6 are in the hypnotic state. So anything you do or say around those young children is downloaded as normal, whether it's dysfunctional or crazy or whatever, they're going to download that. So after 6, then the brain waves start to take off. Between 6 and 12, they get faster, you get alpha. And then as you get older, after 12, you start getting higher or faster brain waves so that you end up being able to meditate and highly focus and create and analyze and discern. So the brain, and there's a time between 10 and 12 or 8 and 12 or so where the brain starts pruning. What it doesn't use, it gets rid of,
mm-hmm.
right? So in these critical developmental stages, you don't want to interfere the brain's development. So from 0 to 6, one sip is probably not going to make a difference, but you cannot come from a family that has alcoholism in its
right.
past, because that's lighting the fuse.
Right.
So no exposure is just a safe way to do it. Between 6 and 12, the brain is pruning as to what's being used and what's not. So you don't want to interfere with that pattern. After 12, it's now starting to grow and focus, and so you don't want to interfere there. So that's early teens, right? And then there's kind of a lull after 18, and then what? It picks up again. The brain starts to develop between the ages of, well, all right, say 18 to 24 years, it has another growth spurt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why college happens at that time, too. It's a critical growth spurt. And so we can take up more information at that time, which is why college isn't when you're 97. It's
right.
usually in your 20s, right? Not
right.
to say that you can't return, because the brain grows
For sure.
its whole life. We used to think that the brain gets so big and then it stops, but we know that now that brain continues to grow throughout your life. And curiously, in the last 100 years, the brain has increased its size by the size of a tennis ball. So we are evolving. The brain has already grown
okay.
a substantial volume in the last 100 years from
wow.
previous. So that's a new study that came out. So we are actually evolving. So we don't know where we're headed. So less is more in this case. You know,
right.
The less that we mess with that process, the faster and the better that will be.
Do you have any just words of wisdom for, like, I'm thinking of the parent who is wanting to raise their child in a space where they're not exposing them to alcohol, they're not setting off those triggers. Do you have any words of wisdom of what to tell the kid, just to, so that it is a, you know, to try to lay that groundwork so when they go to college and that they don't, that they really understand why the parent is protecting them?
Mm-hmm. I think the conversation that's missed all too often is that alcohol is a toxin. It's a poison. And so when people drink it, they start behaving in strange ways and saying strange things. So if we look at it, we would no sooner encourage our children to take a sip of rubbing alcohol,
mm-hmm.
even though a sip isn't going to kill us, right? we wouldn't advise our children to drink poison on any occasion. So this idea of wine, if we just educate our children as to this is a controlled substance for a reason, and we need, as a whole, there are some people that drink it, and it's a poison, it's a kind of poison, so it makes your brain feel funny. And if kids know that, and if you're organic and you're eating healthy, it just becomes part of what we're eating, right? It's just what and why we're choosing to eat or drink that.
Right.
So you normalize it. And so it doesn't become this, oh, what's this? Oh, look at the partying. Look how much fun people are having. You know, it becomes like, oh, yeah, that's another thing I can have.
Mm-hmm.
Is it good for me, like cigarette smoking or not? You know, I choose not to smoke because it's not good for me. I choose to drink very, very little because it's not that good. And as I learn more about the connection to cancer, we start questioning those 4 drinks a week,
right,
too.
Right.
But the beautiful thing about limiting what you're drinking to 4 or less as a woman or 6 or less as a man is that you are always in control of what you're thinking about
mm-hmm.
it. So there will be weeks where you don't drink at all.
Right.
Because you choose not to.
Right.
And over time, if we disconnect the operant conditioning, if we disconnect the trigger, like the stress or the party or the occasion, from the drinking of alcohol, we disconnect that and see it more as a food group that contains
mm-hmm.
toxins,
mm-hmm.
right? Then we naturally reduce what we're drinking. The body will uncouple from consumption and it'll say, oh, this isn't as important because it doesn't have the nutrients. It doesn't. And if, especially if you're in a job where you requires like some really focused thinking, if you're in finances or medicine or counseling or you're writing books or you're in research, it requires really intense use of the prefrontal cortex. So when I was working on my PhD, I was completely abstinent because there was no way I could consume the amount of information that I was consuming, write the papers that needed to be written, learn the material. It was very intense. And if I had even one drink, I couldn't think the next day in order to get the work done. And so that highly focused type of work gets completely interfered with if you have a drink, even though you think you might be relieving stress. 2 days later, you're still not able to focus because you've taken in alcohol.
Right.
And especially if you have highly detailed information, when you have to narrow and focus, it becomes even more important and more essential that you keep your brain clear and free and not fogged up.
Right.
So if you start looking at it as a part of your life in terms of function, not just relaxing and enjoyment, but does this allow me to function at the level I want to function at? Mm-hmm. You will start to really become what I like to call as a conscious drinker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of an oxymoron because once you have the first drink, you're not conscious.
Right.
You're really not.
Right.
And two later, you're really not, especially if you're small, right? So it's about choosing before I start to drink to choose. Well, I'm going to this barbecue and I'm going to have two beers at the most and I'm going to be there for 6 hours and I'll be able to drive home. Or you're going to drive tonight. I'm going to have my allotted two and, you know, drink something else instead. You can drink pop. You can drink water. You can drink carbonated beverages. You can drink juice. There's, you know, the world has a lot of stuff to drink, not just alcohol.
Right.
And the trick to reducing that at parties, have a glass in your hand. Always have a glass in your hand. And then you're choosing what's in it. Because if you don't have a glass in your hand, a good host will come to you and say, can I get you something to drink?
Right.
Okay, I'll, would you like this? And they'll offer you a beer or wine first. And you'll just, you know, politely, okay. And it gets a hold of us and it takes off with us. So having that drink in your hand and choosing what you're putting in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you start the evening. If you want to, if you know you're going to be out to dinner for a long time, you may start with an alcoholic drink and then you can alternate. The next drink you're going to have is maybe ginger ale in a wine glass. Then you still feel like you're drinking wine, but you're really not. Or you're going to drink more of your water. So you alternate every other one. So by the time you've had a glass of wine, a glass of water, a glass of wine, a glass of water, now I'm four drinks. Now I'm going to the bathroom and I'm realizing I'm getting a little tired. It's 9 or 10 and I'm like ready to go home. But that's the over 50 thing, right? So that alternating helps. The planning helps.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're at all curious about your own consumption, then the thing we suggest is, this moderation idea is go 30 days. Go 30 days without drinking. Give it a try. See how uncomfortable you become. If it's no big deal to go 30 days without drinking, then you got this. But if it's a big deal and you start to feel like, oh, I'd really like a glass, and heck with this, I'm not doing this, and you know, you start having these internal battles about whether or not you should have, then you got to start thinking about, do I need to practice planning? Do I need to practice alternating? What can I do to keep my body healthy? And like I say, if we're going to eat organic, if we're going to pay that much attention to our grass-fed butter and our grass-fed, you know, cows and our non-antibiotic chickens and, you know, what's in there, if we're going to pay that much attention to this organic movement, then we need to pay attention to how much alcohol we're consuming.
Right. It's another piece.
It's another piece of that. Yeah.
And the same, some of the things you're saying about thinking about what you're drinking kind of can apply to food and other things as well. And one of the things that I remember coming up a lot in college and that I don't know how you would address, but I think of the purpose of why people drink. Your statement about having fun. I remember being at a work party and one of the girls ordered an alcoholic beverage and somebody kind of made the comment of, do we need to have alcohol? We were at work, so it was still kind of work time.
Yeah.
And she would say, I can't have fun if I don't drink. And he points over to me, who was over having a blast, dancing to this music. And he's like, Judy's having a really good time. She hasn't had a drink, you know. And pointing at other people, and kind of his point, I think, was to sort of make her think a little bit. And then I also think, you know, I think that's definitely something I hear, is alcohol is coupled with that good time.
Social lubricant.
Right, exactly. And I also think about women, or young women especially, who they can't have sex without alcohol. And I think that's that to me, when I hear that, that is so concerning on the amount of alcohol they're drinking, but also the examining of what's that about? Like, that is if that's the thought you're having, my thought is, talk to more people, talk to some, you know,
talk to a therapist.
You're right. Exactly. Because there's a lot of lack of safety in that thinking about not only your lost control of how many drinks you have, because you're not thinking clearly, you're not thinking about the sex you're having and the safety around that.
Yeah.
But the
or
fact
the experience of it.
Exactly.
Connecting with somebody.
Exactly.
The profound experience of meaning it's supposed to be rather than just a quick thrill.
Right. Or even that it can be, you know. Are you training yourself in life to only have those experiences, and where does that take you?
Yeah. Semi-conscious or unconscious.
Yeah.
You're not really in the experience. You're not present.
Right.
Because our memories are made when we're present in the moment. Like, if our mind is on something else, like we're doing one thing, but our mind is on something else, we don't remember what the thing is that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So say we're at the Grand Canyon, right? But we're focused on work. We will not remember what we saw at the Grand Canyon because we're thinking about that. So when you're in the future or in the past thinking about, you know, things that happened, or you're thinking about things that may or may not happen, you're not in the present moment.
Right.
So being present is extremely important. So alcohol takes away your ability to be present. So in the sex act, it may lubricate the sex act when people are usually, you know, just starting and they're afraid or whatever. But it also speaks to other things in society in terms of how unimportant or how much we don't understand what sex does. Like, most people don't know that when women have sex with somebody, they take on their DNA and they carry that the rest of their life. So every person you've ever been with, you have their DNA in your body.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and so because of that, women also, by virtue of having sex, bond to the person that they're having sex with. Men, not so much. They're not made like that. But women are. We are the receivers. So we bond, and that's primal. That comes with our ability to produce young and to have that young taken care of and stay viable as long as possible. So even though now we have the pill,
mm-hmm.
which changed everything, right? Even though we don't necessarily have to have pregnancy that goes along with having sex, what happens is we are still at a primal level bonding with whoever that is. And even if we don't know his name or if we're never going to see him again, right? That's the problem there, because the species is still hardwired and we're not listening to that hardwiring. So being able to really take your time to get to know somebody
mm-hmm.
and decide if this is a serious thing enough, and if this is a responsible enough person, and if we have enough compatibility. There are so much more to just getting drunk and, you know, having a quickie.
Right.
There's more to it than that.
Right.
And I think we would really benefit from educating our young women to what happens to the body when you do choose to have sex with somebody. Not just the sex act, but all this other primal stuff that gets you all connected and changes your psychology and changes your way of thinking and changes you as a person,
right.
Which we're not paying homage to right
we
now.
We don't talk about it. It's much more used as primal and men having sex.
And women, you know, actually have more of an appetite than men. It's just the taboo we don't talk about.
Exactly.
We don't talk about what women will do in order to have sex with somebody. We don't talk about the manipulation. We don't talk about, you know, it used to be a matriarchy. That's primitive and ancient cultures were matriarchies because women had the sexual prowess and the power. It wasn't today where it's to a patriarchy, right? We're male-dominated society. And that was very much designed that way. But back when we used to be in charge, things were different.
Right.
That was very competitive, and it was all about offspring and viability, and the more sexual prowess you had, the more power you had, the more economic resources. It was all tied to the feminine mystique and the feminine empowerment and the divine goddess business and all that. It's
an
all about
interesting
that.
World if we flip that.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And yeah, and then women, you know, who are, again, this is the conversation I mostly heard while I was in college. It was just that they had to do that. And I kept on thinking, well, think about why are you having to do that to numb yourself to have sex? Like, just, I wanted them to just think about it. Think about what's going on. Where is the importance there? And think about what that means culturally when we need to get drunk so we can have sex because it's not really something we're comfortable with, and we're not comfortable with our bodies. And then we have sex because we want to be liked. And it's like this circle of chaos.
Yeah. because we've really forgotten who we are. Women, we aren't. I know that when I was a young girl, I wasn't taught about how incredibly unique and special it is to be a woman on the planet and how much power we actually have. And of course, we all feel that gender trauma of having that matriarchy dissolved, right? That lives in all women. We know that. So this push for equality and all that comes from that switch of the dominant role, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all still trying to get back to that, but we haven't taught our daughters about the sacredness of our power. And that's where, you know, once again, alcohol tricks us into thinking we should be a way that we aren't comfortable with, rather than saying, okay, wait a minute, I am worth, you know, taking a long time to choose my partners, and they need to earn it because I am of a high value state. We don't teach our daughters to be in a high value state. In other words, respect yourself, value yourself, right. And then you're going to be a lot more discerning about your partners and a lot more discerning about the state of how you are. Because if you meet like the best guy, the most handsome, wonderful guy that just is like your Mr. Right, do you really want to show up drunk and sloppy and, right. and like, you know, disheveled?
That's your first interaction, right?
Yeah. And that, no. And anyone looking for the mother of his children is not going to be looking for someone that shows up, you know,
and that's
sloppy.
A primal thing too. Yeah. That's a primal thing too. I read this article in Playboy. Playboy was a male writer. He was giving both men and women a bit of a hard time in saying, women, you're making it way too easy for men, and men are not having to work to learn how to be good in a relationship. They're not having to work for your respect and your love, and you need to make them work harder to be better people.
There was a study
that was really interesting.
Yeah, there was a study done on the 3-question rule, and that is when women are out in the bar, and it depends on how much skin they're showing as to how available they are and how many pheromones they're putting out, right? And of course, the peak is 2 weeks before you menstruate, then you're putting out a massive amount of pheromones. You have men around you like fleas. I'll say like bees to honey, right? Or like bees to pollen. You've got them all around you. So one of the things we know is when a man asks a woman, you know, do you want to have sex? The first time she'll usually answer no. The second time he'll wait a while and wait and ask again. The second time she'll say no because she still sees prospects, right? But the third time, if a man waits and asks a third time, the answer is usually yes. It's the three. And if this got out... would be a problem because this when the study was done, they found that most women will say yes to sex if asked 3 times.
Wow.
Once or twice, no, but the third time. So men who are persistent will always find a partner, and women who aren't choosy will always find a partner. Right? So that's why you need to know that if someone asks you a third time, red flag.
They've read the study.
No. I know the study. I'm not saying yes, go away. The answer is still no, right?
Wow. Yeah. Sex and culture and alcohol, all of this is so interesting, and we don't talk about it enough.
We don't.
And we
make it to be really bad. We make it out to be the bad guy.
Well, and that's another case. It's another thing where we're looking at the negativity.
Always.
And we're not looking at the positive, and we're not even just having calm conversations. They're usually many times, and more people are, I think people are trying to have those, but more often than not, it's adverse conversations, whether it's sex or alcohol.
We're not talking about the moderate conversation.
Right.
Because we live in a primarily abstinence-based culture when it comes to alcohol. I mean, we had the prohibition. I mean, the first inebriate conferences where they decided to start limiting alcohol was as far back as 1870 and sooner, you know, in this country. But 1870, there was an institute for inebriation. And so that's when they started identifying alcohol as a problem. And then, you know, fast forward to the 30s, 40s, we've got the prohibition. So we've been this abstinence-based group of people long before AA even came on. They just sort of went with the cultural idea. So it's always been that way. In 325, they distilled gin, and that's when they realized and called it spirits. Why? Because when people drank distilled alcohol, it was far different than beer and wine at the time. People would get really drunk really fast and behave as though they were possessed by spirits.
I always wondered where that came from.
So it was called that. And that's as far back as 325. And that's also when they coined the term alcoholism. It's a very old term.
Okay.
And that's many, many years ago, thousands of years ago even.
So then I think of Europe, I think, like you said, in different cultures, it's different. It's not just the alcohol, clearly. It is the cultural pieces and the discussions we're having around it. Yeah. So we need to take lessons from those other countries where, you know, it's interesting talking to people from Europe sometimes. Like, I don't understand Americans in the bars and they're coming out. So we don't do that there.
Public drunkenness is frowned upon in Europe. I mean, I've traveled there many times and you can't be drunk in a pub. You can be loud, but if you stumble out, it's not respected at all. So you'll see people out drinking, but you will rarely see somebody really, really, really drunk because it's frowned upon in general.
Right.
You will, there, not to say that that doesn't exist because they are having a crisis there now.
Sure.
I do get a weekly newsletter from a SHAP journal from the UK, and they are, the way that they're curbing drinking there is to increase taxes on alcohol. So they're really increasing the prices of beer and wine and cider and alcohol because it's just, they're at epidemic and crisis proportions, especially in Scotland. And of course, if you've ever been to Scotland or plan on going, there's a distillery every couple of miles. Uh-huh. Every stream has its own, you know, with its own special brand of scotch, and the alcoholism is just rampant there.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they're really working on decreasing the number of pints and identifying what a drink is. And there's a big movement, lots of studies, lots of ER visits like that are increasing in certain age groups, and it's getting pretty bad. And I have to say the baby boomers are holding their own in this for sure. They're representing quite a large segment of this drinking issue because back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it was drinking, there was a whole different idea about what drinking was and how things go. I can recall back in high school, if we would come back one evening, we were coming back from the beach where there had been drinking going on, and I was little and I wasn't drunk, and so they chose me to drive a car. So we were all driving back in this big blue car, and the driver was drunk and put it in a ditch very near a bridge. If it had been 100 feet, 50 feet more, we'd have been in the river and dead. But no, we happened to come down this hill and end up in a ditch very near the river. And the police officers were out looking for kids, and they found us. And it happened that the police officer, now this is back in the 70s, the police officer said, we're going to take a ride around this, you know, 2-3 miles. If we come back and you're still here, you're going to get a ticket. But if you're not here, we won't ticket you.
Whoa.
So being that I was little, I was the littlest one, and I was not drunk, and they had to get the car out of the ditch. They made me drive because I was small, right? And put it in reverse and get the car out. And everybody gathered around and pushed the car out. And I backed it and did what the boys told me to gun it or whatever and got the car out of the ditch. And then we all piled back in and drove back to town. And nothing else was, you know, ever said about it. That doesn't happen today. And when I think about those types of experiences, it was like, oh, my gosh, we are all lucky to be alive back then, right?
Yeah.
And this would have been in this, I don't know, mid-70s, late-70s.
Wow.
Yeah, a long time ago, and we don't do that anymore, thank goodness. But
wow.
Being that that was the norm for baby boomers in high school, they're returning to that.
Right.
Nothing more well illustrated than if you watch Grace and Frankie on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah, that is a wonderful sociological comment on aging in America and affluence and what happens. And even though the theme there is that the husbands get together because they've had a long relationship over the years and all the wives are, you know, living at the beach house, but they frequently show marijuana use, drinking, and taking of pills along with the drinking.
Mm,
it's like
mm-hmm.
normalized in that program. And I think
it's true,
how many people look at that program and normalize their, oh yeah, it's not bad because they're doing it on the show.
Right. It's an interesting thing because I love that show, or at least
do.
The first few seasons. But it's an interesting thing because I think about that doesn't affect me. Like I think about that's what they do and that's their thing and that's not my thing.
Yeah.
But you're right. Other... If it's you're taking it in, or it's something
it's a subliminal
that you can
thing.
Recognize
it's just part of the normal
as,
behavior of the characters.
Right. And so, yeah, people are going to process that differently about what's okay about that.
And the older you get, if you do that, the older you get, the more dangerous it becomes because your blood volume goes down. So that's
right.
The real problem. So if you learn to moderate early on, if you get used to the idea that I'm not going to drink more than 4 drinks a week or 6 for men, like that's it. Our normal drinking is maybe go out to dinner and have 2 drinks on Friday, and maybe there's Wednesday, I've got to go somewhere for business, I'll have one there, and maybe Sunday afternoon, if it's raining, we're watching a movie, I'll have a glass of wine. And then that's it. That's it for the whole week.
Right.
You're not drinking during school nights or work nights.
Right.
And you just manage it that way. Then that normalizing of low consumption becomes the normal pattern as you age, and then you're not at risk for the cancers and the inflammation and the aging and the brain changes and the, you know, all the other things, the cirrhosis and the pancreatitis and all the things that can happen.
Right.
You're not at risk.
Right.
So you can do this. You can drink in a healthful way for the long term. If you moderate, the earlier you learn to moderate, the easier it's going to be.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
But with that said, if you have alcoholism in your background and if you've gotten into a place where you can't control your drinking, I always recommend that people get an assessment, and then you'll know how big and how bad and how much this is. So you can get an assessment just at any treatment center.
Oh, okay.
And I know here in Duluth, St. Louis County Social Services also has assessments available there, and and some are at cost, some are free depending on your income. So always, if you're in any doubt, you can actually pick up the phone and talk to somebody. Also, if you're in a prominent position, you can go to treatment online. And so there aren't many places that do this yet. I happen to work for one online treatment center, and they're called Lion Rock Recovery. And that's how I work with people all over the world, because they can't go to a local treatment center, and or they can't leave their work because it's too important for them to go. But they need to learn to moderate on the job so they can still come to treatment. They can still get all the information. They can still learn, you know, have accountability. We still drug test them, the whole nine yards.
Right.
But you get to do it from the comfort of your own home. And if you're in a rural area, that really works for you because we do take insurance.
Oh.
So you can't drive, or, you know, you can't drive from the range, Iron Range, way up there where there might not be the treatment, right? And it's cold and it's winter, and maybe you've got a DWI where you don't have your vehicle anymore or something, and you need to still get treatment. If you can do it online, and it's face-to-face, video conferencing, video groups, and everyone that works online is all licensed in many, many states, usually multiple degrees and certifications, and so it's a very viable
thing. That's great.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that, because sometimes we have like prominent people in communities, like, for instance, it may be like high finance executives, or it may be attorneys, or it may be engineers, like the kind of folks that I've had all over the world have these really big executive jobs, and it just is not possible. Or maybe where they are, they're expatriates and they're in a very remote area of the of the world, and there is no treatment. And they're having trouble, or their wife's having a trouble, and there's no English speaking services of this kind. So what do they do? So this makes it very accessible for anywhere. Anybody who has Wi-Fi can actually have treatment,
which is nice, because even if you're not a prominent person, perhaps you know that your job is on edge or something, and you want to do it privately and just take care of it in your own space.
For some of my clients, Alcoholics Anonymous is even too public. Like if you go, like for instance, in the Twin Ports, we have lots of wonderful support meetings. You can go, I think there's 144 meetings between the Twin Ports for AA and Al-Anon. So there's lots of places to show up. But in a small community also, there's likely you're going to run into somebody you know, and you might not want to do that.
Right.
Not that there's any shame in it, but some people just want more privacy than others. And I don't think we should call that bad or wrong or anything. I think it's okay to want to keep your business your own business. But you also need to talk to somebody. What do I do?
Yes, absolutely.
And also, if you're questioning, if you have a question in your mind about, am I drinking too much or not? Well, we've talked about what are healthy and safe levels to drink. Right? But you can always make a phone call and ask, you know, and I can be reached too on my LinkedIn.
Yeah. Please share your information as to how to get a hold of you or work with you.
Well, I'm also on the Northland Coaching Consortium. So we have a website, and that's...
Hey, this is Judy. I don't mean to interrupt the flow. However, we had a little issue with the website, and I just want to make sure that we get it in here right where it belongs, so that anybody can find Michelle or the other coaches. This is the Northland Coaching Consortium, and the website to find Michelle here is northlandcoachingc.wixsite.com/website. So it's northlandcoachingc, C stands for consortium, .wixsite, which is wixsite.com/website. And you can also check the show notes, of course, where everything is listed out. And she will continue on to give you that information right here in the podcast, too.
And I'm on that and listed in there. Also, you can reach me through LinkedIn, which is my current page. It's Michelle Perron, M-I-C-H-E-L-E-1-L, Perron, P-E-R-R-O-N. PhD. I'm on there, and there's contact data. My current website is down right now because I'm getting a new one redone, and so once that's on, then I can include that information. But certainly through the Northland Coaching Consortium or the LinkedIn page.
Okay.
And I do private recovery and addiction coaching through my own personal service. If you need insurance to, you know, if you need to kick in your insurance, we can also go through this online treatment service with Lion Rock Recovery. And you can also call them up and ask whatever questions. We have wonderful intake people that are licensed to talk to you about your drinking. So you can ask questions. There's a lot of information out there. Sometimes just having one conversation with someone who's an expert in the field can really make a big difference as to setting your mindset about what this is and where I fall in this continuum.
Right.
Yeah.
And to be able to know that you can, there's a place you can go that there isn't shameful, or you're not judged. It is, you have a question and you need an answer to your question.
I'd much rather have someone come to me who is maybe nervous or afraid to ask the question, but is curious and wants to know, than to just go on never asking the question and then having something go wrong for them, a health issue or an accident or something. I'd rather have you ask. And I have no judgment about this. I've been working in this field for a long time. I do consume alcohol, but, you know, no more than 4 in a week, and many weeks not at all, because I need to have my brain functioning well.
Right.
And more than anything, I really started to be a conscious consumer in that I noticed that when I did drink, I couldn't function at the high level that I need to in my profession and for my interests. And so that was the thing that curbed my drinking almost more than anything else, was I started to realize that I'm not functioning at the level that I need to be functioning at. So what are safe levels that don't change my brain and naturally get me to want to drink more? That's when I found Dr. Amen, and that's when I really support and advocate for his levels, which are quite a bit lower than the CDC.
Right, that makes sense. Anything else you want to share?
Just, I think alcohol is something that can be enjoyed for a lifetime, so long as you use it wisely.
Great, thank you. This has been really fantastic.
Thanks.
I love it. This is good. I want to repeat Michelle's information. She said that you could find her on LinkedIn. The link is up in the show notes, but if you look for Michelle with one L, D. Perron, P-E-R-R-O-N, PhD, you should find her. And then the website she mentioned with the Northland Coaching Consortium. The Northland Coaching Consortium, and you will most likely be learning more about them on a future podcast, a group of coaches are collectively forming, and so all of their resources are online. So she is one of many coaches, and coaches of different types. So it might be health and wellness. There's life coaches. There are people helping you figure out what your strengths are and how to go forward and utilize them the best way. There's a person who does college success coaching and a bunch of other people. So she is listed there with them, and you can find her there. Thank you so much for listening. You can check out the rest of the Wellness Renaissance podcast at wellnessrenpodcast.com. You can connect with me on Facebook, facebook.com/wellnessren. If you like what I do and you like the information that we're putting out, please consider supporting us. There are a couple different ways you can do that. There are multiple different ways you can do that, actually. One of them is going to the wellnessrenpodcast.com site. You'll see a support the podcast link, and that will take you to a page with all of the Amazon books and various things that have been mentioned on the podcast. You can click on that. You do not have to purchase any of those specific items, but if you take that link through to the Amazon website, whatever you do purchase on that shopping trip, a small portion, not an extra added cost, but a small portion of your purchase will go to support the podcast. We are also excited to have a Patreon page. You can check out a Patreon page at patreon.com/wellnessren. That's patreon.com/wellnessren. And if you're not familiar with Patreon, basically it is a way for people who create to have a easy way for people to support them through small or large, not going to turn that down, payments that just basically allow the person to keep doing what they're doing and creating what they're creating. And, you know, sharing the podcast with anyone here in our area who might enjoy health and wellness information, but nationally as well. A lot of this information, we're talking to a lot of people from Duluth, but there's a lot of information that can apply across the board about modalities, et cetera, et cetera. So please consider doing that. That is, like I said, that's a huge help. If you've subscribed on iTunes and you have a moment to leave a review, that would be fantastic too. If you like the podcast and you don't want to have to remember to go to the website each week and you don't do iTunes, go ahead and go to the website once, to the wellnessrenpodcast.com website. You'll look on the left below the Patreon button. You're going to see where you can sign up for the emails. And all we do is send that information, the title, the show notes that goes out to you right in your email box. You can take a look at it. And when you listen to the podcast, just click on the link and it's going to open it right up for you. Press play and you're good to go. Thank you so much for listening. I almost just said, so keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars. And if anybody recognizes that reference, that would be Casey Kasem. I don't know where that came from, but that is what I almost automatically said. What I mean to say, although I agree with the other sentiment, is again, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, here is to you finding the pieces to your health and wellness puzzle. Have a wonderful week.